Hi, Kirsty Melville here. Welcome to the Earshot podcast. And in this episode, we're kicking off a brand new, utterly gripping, four-part series about the hidden history of eugenics. Natasha Mitchell's been digging into a dark and difficult past, and she's taking us back in time, not too far back though, just to America and Australia last century, when the fledgling science of genetics and the idea that you could breed a superior race took hold of influential progressive reformers right across the West. The consequences were chilling, surprising and dramatic, as you'll hear. This is a story about misplaced power, science and social engineering. And it's not over yet, but that's for a later episode. Today, in part one, we're heading to the USA.
And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
America is many things. It's apple pie. And it's Oprah.
Now this is a fascinating Hollywood family.
It's the Statue of Liberty and Red Sox games. But here's something you might not associate with the good old US of A. Eugenics. That's a word that carries with it the heaviness of history, horror scenes of Hitler and the Holocaust, of genocide and gas chambers, of the Nazi quest to breed a master race through the sterilisation and murder of millions of innocent people, deemed defective, unfit, unwanted. But as you're about to hear, the idea of eugenics wasn't just exploited by a despotic regime in the chaos of a world war. Before that, eugenics found its feet firmly in mainstream America, with catastrophic consequences for tens of thousands of Americans across the 20th century.
I wish very much that the wrong people could be prevented entirely from breeding. And when the evil nature of these people is sufficiently flagrant, this should be done. Criminals should be sterilized and feeble-minded persons forbidden to leave offspring behind them.
That's not Hitler. That is former American President Theodore Roosevelt in 1914. And a decade later, the case of one young girl, labelled feeble-minded, was to set a dangerous precedent in American law. I first heard about her while living in America 10 years ago. She was mentioned in a medical anthropology class. And what I heard that day was so disturbing, so incomprehensible, that it stayed seared into my psyche ever since. Hers is a story to know, and really, one never to forget. It's the story of
Carrie Buck. My name is Carrie Buck.
Date of birth?
July 2, 1906.
I'm 18 years old. I was born in Charlottesville, Virginia.
Mother?
Well, my mother is Emma Harlow Buck. And my father, you say? He was Frank Buck, but he's gone to God now. And mother, she's shut away in the colony. They call it the colony for epileptics and feeble-minded. Though I'm not sure she's either of those things.
Lowest grade, moron class.
Lowest grade, moron class.
Feeble-minded.
Feeble-minded.
They say she lacks moral sense and responsibility. They say I do too.
Congenitally and incurably defective.
Mental age, 9 years.
They would say that. They took me out of school in the sixth grade. I love school. I love to learn. I love to sing. Well, Mr. John and Alice Dobbs are my foster parents. I've been under their roof since I was 3 years old. But I'm not sure they think of me as their daughter. I'm really their servant girl. And now... well, now I'm their sinner too. I'm in trouble. Such terrible, terrible trouble.
Let me tell you what happened to a woman one day. She was pretty.
74. 75 now, I'm sorry. 75. 1941. I'm Rosemary Brooks. I'm from Lynchburg all my life. At 16, I was pregnant. I was like rape charge. This man forced me. And I said to myself, it's just terrible to think about what happened. And I came back later and I said, Grandma, what's going on? And I had to go to the doctor. And she said, well, you know what you are having? You are pregnant. And I said, what? I didn't know what it meant.
These are the words of the woman just before she died.
You gave birth to
two twins. Yeah, sure did. And I said, well, what can I do, Grandma? She said, well, Rose, you can't keep them because you don't know everything about it. I said, well, I know I don't, but it's still my flesh and blood, you know. Oh, it was really heartbreaking. I said, well, I give them up for adoption because I know they'll get education. And I had to go through court to get rid of the children. And then I had to be placed in the training center. It was like a jail. They just like prison there.
Rose Brooks, she never met Carrie Buck, but these two women, born a generation apart, lived strikingly parallel lives in Lynchburg, Virginia. Both came from poor families, and both found themselves incarcerated in the then Virginia State Colony for Epileptics and Feeble-Minded after being raped and giving birth to babies they weren't allowed to keep. In Rose's case, twin boys, born in 1958. Carrie's daughter Vivian was born in 1924, and while inside the colony, later renamed the Lynchburg Training School, it still stands on the same site today, both were sterilized.
They would tell me about how they had a family, how social workers, or in some case, how police officers would come to their house and strip them from their homes. The teachers, other government officials would basically kind of tell on them, right? I mean, and they would be stripped from their families simply because maybe they weren't doing that well in school, for example, in Rose's case, or that she, similar to Carrie Buck, many of them had been raped and therefore they got pregnant. And so they were considered promiscuous. Probably the first three victims that I met with, I would cry. I just found it incredibly heartbreaking.
Mark Bold stumbled across the hidden history of eugenic sterilization in America as a law student and was overcome by what he heard.
The why, I think, is what most people don't understand.
Actually, Mark's own story is interesting here too. Compelled to make a difference in the world as he was approaching 40, he threw in a successful business career to study law. And along the way, he set up the Justice for Sterilization Victims Project, which seeks out and represents survivors of eugenic sterilization, like Rose Brooks. He is determined that they be compensated for what governments did to them.
It really was a systematic approach to getting rid of people who were poor, people who were considered on welfare or entitlement programs, right? If they can just go ahead and through the means of sterilization, sterilize folks, then none of their, quote, kind would exist anymore. And therefore, the state had an interest under its police powers, this is how it was held constitutional, for the general welfare of society to ensure that these types of people wouldn't exist again. And so, again, it was a systematic effort to kill them off so we wouldn't be, quote, swamped with imbecility.
That fear of society being swamped with imbecility, well, that's what led to an estimated 70,000 Americans being sterilized under eugenic laws. 70,000 people. Imagine that. I didn't know that, did you? And the real number is hard to know, in fact. Many believe there are countless more undocumented and unreported cases hidden inside prisons and institutions and specific communities. Native Americans were allegedly targeted, for example, and as recently as 2010, women in Californian prisons were being sterilized against their will.
I don't have any memory of the term eugenics before about 1980. If I had read it, I'd forgotten it. But I happened to be reading the newspaper. I was a student in graduate school, and I came across the story of a lawsuit that was going on.
Paul Lombardo is a prominent legal scholar and Bobby Lee Cook Professor of Law at Georgia State University.
The lawsuit was challenging this very old practice of eugenic sterilization, laws that would allow the state to decide who could have children and perform operations on the ones who could not. What I didn't realize was that the town where I was studying, Charlottesville, Virginia, was the place where the most famous case in the eugenics movement took place, where a young lady named Carrie Buck had been born and eventually took a case to the Supreme Court about eugenic sterilization. So my first inkling of what this movement was about really was focused directly on the person who became famous because of it.
And that first inkling turned into a passionate quest for Paul Lombardo. He's dedicated years to unearthing and exposing the details of Carrie Buck's story, digging into dusty archives and searching for records, piecing together evidence to find out what really happened to Carrie and thousands after her. He even managed to track Carrie down in person just days before she died in 1983, as we'll hear in episode 2.
Well, the summer that Carrie turned 16, Carrie was left in the home alone during the day. And apparently at that point, a young man whom Carrie had gone to school with, who was the nephew of the Dobbses, was also there. Carrie became pregnant, and she would later claim that he forced himself upon me, she said.
And afterwards, there was no one to tell. Who wanted to know my shame? And then when I found out I was with child, well, he said he would marry me. But then he disappeared.
And her foster parents were getting quite desperate. They were going to be embarrassed with having a foster child who had gotten pregnant. And not only was she not married, but the boy who was to blame was one of their relatives. And so they approached the authorities and they took out a statement saying that Carrie was epileptic and feeble-minded, and so she was taken away as soon as her baby was born to the colony in near the town of Lynchburg.
Unwittingly, 16-year-old Carrie was about to become a pawn in a bigger agenda, orchestrated by a group of prominent, powerful men, determined to introduce eugenic sterilization laws, first in Virginia, and then right across America. They wanted to create a fit and efficient human race, and they needed one convincing case study to prove why. This was to become what some describe as the century of eugenics.
This is an era where industries are becoming mechanized, where cars are being made on assembly lines, where people are working in factories according to very strict routines. And the idea of efficiency, having time and motion controlled so that there was no wasted movement in creating things like cars, that idea was also applied to humans. Come up with the most efficient human beings who wouldn't waste energy or waste resources. That was also something that was part of the eugenics movement.
The good intentions behind it were that progressives were people who believed that science and technology could be harnessed to make a better world, and particularly when combined with the power of the government.
Adam Cohen is a writer and lawyer. He's the author of Imbeciles, the Supreme Court and the Sterilization of Carrie Buck.
They thought that if we took the scientific advances that were being made in genetics and made government policy out of them, we could make for a better humanity. And a lot of the medical doctors who supported eugenics, they thought, well, we've been trying to cure some of these diseases for years. Wouldn't it be great if we could actually breed them out? So that was kind of the positive side, although this was progressivism, you know, really going on a very wrong track. But then the more negative side was that there was this anxiety. People think of the 1920s in America when eugenics really caught on as being a sort of carefree time. You think of the movies and F. Scott Fitzgerald novels with flappers and, you know, speakeasies and wild parties. But in fact, it was a time of considerable anxiety. Immigration was at the highest level in American history and had been for a couple of decades, and the nation was changing. There were foreigners coming in, people with different nationalities and religions and skin colors. There were people moving from the farms to the big cities, and family ties were breaking down. A lot of historians say that the entire progressive movement was in many ways an attempt by the middle and upper classes to try to exert a little bit of control over a society that they were losing control of. And one of the ways that this anxiety manifested itself was, well, we can't stop all these immigrants from coming, or at least right away they eventually did do that. We can't stop, you know, the movement to the big cities, but we can try to do something about the gene pool.
And that's when things started to get out of control.
I'm coming for Jimmy. I'm coming to stay. Don't hold it again, babe. Or run away.
What nature does blindly, slowly, and ruthlessly, man may do providently, quickly, and kindly, as it lies within his power. So it becomes his duty to work in that direction. The improvement of our stock seems to me one of the highest objects that we can reasonably attempt. Francis Galton, 1883.
The man who coined the term eugenics, which means good birth in Greek, was a man named Francis Galton, who was actually a half-cousin of Charles Darwin, and it was influenced by Darwinian ideas, the idea that man and beast were in a battle of survival of the fittest, and the eugenicists and Francis Galton thought, well, we can help that process along, we can help the selection along if we decide who should reproduce and who shouldn't reproduce.
And so the eugenics movement was born.
It comes to America and it's pretty quickly adopted in many different directions. Among researchers and academics, it inspires them to start doing a series of studies where they send researchers out into poor rural communities around America, and they find families, large families that have a lot of poverty and delinquency in them, and they try to show through family trees that these are inherited characteristics which, you know, eugenics could possibly solve. But it's also adopted by the popular press. In popular magazines, there were articles about eugenic marriage and how this would really uplift the human race.
I took care of my grandmother because my mother died. She died childbirth. And I didn't have no brothers. I had uncles which drank when I had to get out of there in either way. And all my people died. So I had just grandmother. And I learned to clean up for her. I learned to do everything else. I learned to cook. Something like Cinderella. Fade away. Nobody treats you like mother well. And then she said, Rose, I just can't take care of you no more. I said, what do you call that? Fever mind. I was fever mind, my grandma said. And the court said it too. I just felt bad because I wasn't.
As this is a time when mental testing is coming into its own, ways of screening people and trying to determine who might need a little extra help in school, they very quickly became used for much more dark purposes, identifying who would be excluded from school or who would be excluded in some cases from the military, people that you wouldn't hire in a job, or eventually people that you would decide shouldn't have any children. So the mental testing movement came up with terms, grafted them on to the old-fashioned terms like idiot and imbecile, terms that matched the new IQ tests. And one of those terms was moron. A moron was someone who wasn't dysfunctional physically, but someone who was just weak enough mentally to be easily swayed toward evil, just weak enough to make bad judgments. And these terms were affixed to people who were in institutions, in some cases, people identified when they were in school, but they became a ready way of marking and labeling people who would become the objects of the laws passed in the name of eugenics.
Not to an examination, they decided there was but one important action to take. To have your entire family sterilized.
Well, what's that?
Eugenic thinking entered the popular consciousness. There were movies with eugenic plot lines.
Now, in this state, we have a law which provides for such people to have an operation so there won't be any more children.
Fitter Families contests were run across America, the first at the Kansas State Free Fair in 1920. To compete, you submitted a record of family traits, your family were prodded and poked and examined physically and psychologically, and given a grade for eugenic health. If you were lucky, you got a bronze medallion inscribed with the words, "Yay, I have a goodly heritage."
And you mean they're going to stop me from having children ever?
Exactly.
So it really was embraced by the culture, and hundreds of universities and colleges, including the very finest American universities, taught eugenics. It was a real popular movement.
We don't want any trouble with you, young woman. If you refuse to go, the officer here will take you by force.
And there was talk of the menace of the feeble-minded.
Yeah, that's right. And there was this mania that we were being swamped by a tide of feeble-mindedness. But what did it mean? It could mean, as in Carrie's case, that someone had performed less than acceptably on an intelligence test, and these were terrible tests that were badly designed and badly administered. It could be that you were deemed to be not very intelligent. Various other people who did things that, you know, the middle-class arbiters of conduct, the judges and the social workers didn't like, got thrown into this category as well. So there were instances in which women were deemed to be feeble-minded because they were too interested in sex, or, you know, a woman who was thought to maybe be a prostitute might be labeled feeble-minded instead. So it was really a tool that was used to send away people that the powers that be wanted sent away.
If you were feeble-minded, then you might be feeble of will, unable to control yourself. And if you were a woman, that might mean that you were promiscuous, that you were immoral, that you were shiftless. This was another term they used to describe people who weren't quite grounded, a bit peculiar perhaps, out of the ordinary and unable to get along in polite society.
A bit peculiar, perhaps, out of the ordinary. Are you listening to Paul Lombardo and thinking, well, that kind of sounds like me, that could have been me, that could have been any of us? Yeah, me too.
And I wanted education. I couldn't get it. And I wanted to be a nurse. And the devil did show up. I could be a nurse in school. And it took me out like the fifth grade. Well, I love to spell and I love history. I love stuff like that. And I didn't like coming out of school because I loved the children. I loved the teachers. They said I couldn't learn nothing. Oh, yes, I can learn things. Not all the way, nobody's perfect, but we can come down to it, that everybody has to learn things on their own, and God helps. And still, I know how to read right today. If it wasn't for God, I wouldn't.
What might have become of us, Rose? I found some peace. I know you did too, Rose. But they done you wrong, Rose. They done me wrong, taking school and motherhood away from us like that. They done all of us wrong, Rose.
There's thousands of people ain't got no place to go.
The eugenicists worked in a number of practical ways. Initially, it was to prevent or advise on who should marry who. And then where did it move? And this is where Carrie Buck's story really comes into its own.
The problem was that the eugenicists soon realized that these groups would just reproduce outside of marriage. That didn't really solve the problem. So the next thing they thought of was so-called segregation. They thought if we could just move the genetically unfit people into colonies, like the Virginia Colony for Epileptic and Feeble-Minded, during their reproductive years, then, you know, we could stop them from reproducing. The problem with that, though, was that eugenicists felt that as many as 15 million people in the United States had bad genes and had to be stopped from reproducing. And they realized they could not segregate 15 million people and put them in institutions. It would be too expensive, too logistically difficult.
There ain't no place for a poor old girl to go.
A new technology came on the scene, which made looking at people as reproductive animals a lot easier. A vasectomy, the ability to prevent a man from having children, became feasible right around 1900. At the same time, advances in anesthesiology and in control of infection allowed for more serious surgery to be done on women, a way of tying off the fallopian tubes. So the eugenicist had a way of identifying people with tests, putting them in institutions so that they couldn't have children, but then most dramatically and most radically deciding that some of those people you could simply operate on, and then if they were only morons, they could go out and work, under supervision at least, but they couldn't have children.
So then they really moved on to this idea of eugenic sterilization. And with one operation, you could then even let that person go and lead their lives in freedom because they would no longer be able to pass on their genes.
So on that basis, it was sterilization was seen as a benevolent eugenic act. It was good for the person being sterilized. It was good for the gene pool. It was good for society.
And good for the taxpayer, yeah. People saw it as win-win-win, exactly.
Yeah, all of us had to go through that operation, every one of us. But I said, no, why do I have to have it done? And he said, you gotta have it done before you can go anywhere. Oh, you can't leave your grand, you can't get a job, no nothing. I said, I'm not feeble-minded, I know where I'm at, I know what I'm doing. They said it was very important to me to have it done. I said, I don't think so. I think I should have kids and get married later. I felt real bad. I felt bad about all of them. I say, why are they doing this, Lord? I know they do it against you, but they got against me too. I say, why do they want to do something like it in America? That we can't have our own ability to stand up for our own self.
It was 11 long years before Rose was finally allowed to leave the Virginia State Colony of Epileptics and Feeble-Minded, a decade after she was sterilised. But before Rose Brooks, what happened to Carrie Buck? A story of misplaced power and the Supreme Court case of Buck versus Bell. That's next in The Hidden History of Eugenics with RN's Natasha Mitchell. Thanks also to sound engineer Stephen Tilley. And you can delve further into the issue of eugenics on the Earshot website, where you'll find links and photos, and where you can also listen to the rest of the series right now if you can't wait. The rest of the episodes are also up on your podcast feed if you're a subscriber. I'm Kirsty Melville, and I'll catch you for part two of The Hidden History of Eugenics next up on Earshot. See you then.